The final volume of Ian Toll's definitive history of the Pacific War, Twilight of the Gods, War in the Western Pacific, 1944 to 1945, comes on the 75th anniversary of the surrender ceremony in Tokyo Bay, marking the formal close of World War II. It is narrative history full of drama and the texture of lived reality, of decisions and actions with consequences. The book encompasses all aspects of the war, bringing each into focus, arresting both the heroic and the tragic, the powerful and the powerless, diplomat and warrior, sailor and admiral, American and Japanese, winner and loser. One that by its conclusion had transformed the future of the 20th century and beyond. Ian Toll's new book is Twilight of the Gods. His past books include the New York Times bestseller The Conquering Tide, Pacific Crucible, and Six Frigates. It is a great pleasure to welcome Ian Toll to the Roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Joe. Thanks.
I guess I want to back up a little bit to talk about the desire to tell this story over three volumes.
Yeah, so originally I had envisioned this as a one-volume history of the Pacific War. I can hardly believe that I ever thought that was possible. And I started writing the book, and I had about 800 pages written, and I realized I'd only gotten through the Battle of Midway, which is 6 months into a war that lasted 44 months. And my publisher was good enough to say, why don't we just turn this into a trilogy? So that's what we did.
So as I mentioned, the dates here, War in the Western Pacific, 1944 to 1945. So this is the conclusion. So bring us up to the point where that just those 2 years support this volume in the sense of all that was going on to culminate and end the war.
Yeah, so this book picks up after the conquest of the Mariana Islands and the accompanying naval battle called the Battle of the Philippine Sea, which occurred in June and July 1944. And as of that point in the Pacific War, it was really clear, both to the Americans and to the Japanese, that the war was essentially over. The decisive strategic battles had been lost by the Japanese. The Japanese had lost, their naval capabilities. And it was clear at that point that that the Americans had the capacity to land on any island and to take it. And so really the last year of the war became a contest of wills, in which the Japanese were essentially determined not to surrender unconditionally, and in particular not to allow an occupation force onto Japanese soil without a fight. And that was what the last year of this campaign was about. It was an absolutely terrible war, and some 1.5 million Japanese civilians and servicemen died just in that final year of the war, in fighting on land, on sea, the strategic bombing of Japanese cities, and then finally, of course, the two atomic bombs.
Let's talk for a moment about the personalities here and how you were able, through these three volumes and specifically in this book, of telling this through these stories, but also not having them overwhelm it in the sense of, you have a Douglas MacArthur, you have a Chester Nimitz, and yet we learn through them and their personalities, but we also find out what is happening as a result of their actions.
Yeah, so the rivalries between the services were an absolutely important aspect of this conflict. FDR was a Navy man. He had been Assistant Secretary of the Navy during the Woodrow Wilson administration. And he really backed the Navy's concept of how to fight and win the war in the Pacific. On the other hand, MacArthur, as the senior Army officer in the Pacific and the theater commander in the South Pacific, had a greater stature in American society than any other military commander in either the Pacific or in Europe. His command of publicity, and his personal fame, his celebrity, gave him a certain kind of power, which he used very deliberately in order to obtain command. He wanted supreme command of Allied forces in the Pacific. Failing that, he wanted at least to receive the lion's share of military assets. And so this was a surprisingly virulent conflict within the Allied camp, between the Army and the Navy, between MacArthur and Admiral Chester Nimitz, and ultimately between MacArthur and FDR. In fact, MacArthur even implicitly challenged FDR in the 1944 campaign. And so this struggle within the Allied camp, this internecine rivalry, has really colored every aspect of the Pacific campaign.
You tell the beginning of the meeting at the beginning of the book, and then we get into the focus of the Navy and the portraits there. I'm interested in your interest of the Navy and how that comes through so clearly in this volume.
Yeah, I mean, I began my writing career with a history of the founding of the U.S. Navy in a book called Six Frigates, which came out 14 years ago. And my idea really was to try to take that story forward to the kind of other bookend, the point at which the U.S. Navy became the most powerful navy in the world by an enormous margin, and in which we fought and ultimately won the largest naval war that has ever been waged, probably the largest that will ever be waged, and we can hope that that's true. And it had always seemed to me that the Pacific War had been neglected somewhat in relation to the much more kind of larger and better known campaign in Europe. But also, as a continental nation, I think that we have often sort of slipped into the sense of thinking of the Pacific campaign as a series of island battles. Really, it was, before anything, it was a naval and air campaign in which fighting on islands was a sort of subsidiary or supporting operation. And so I wanted to restore the naval campaign to where I think it belongs. It's really the spine of the narrative when you tell the story of what happened in the Pacific.
Why do you think that in some ways it's been overlooked?
Well, the war in the Pacific and the war in Europe were really two different wars that happened at the same time. And you can read a thousand books on the war against Hitler and know very little about what happened in the Pacific. And so the idea that you can sort of think of yourself as an expert on the Second World War, I think, is a mirage. You really have to take these two conflicts as separate conflicts and understand them in that way. And Europe was the main focus. Our policy as the United States and with our allies was a policy of Europe first. That meant that we were going to defeat Hitler first. We were going to devote the lion's share of our effort to Europe. I think that policy was correct. And yet the war in the Pacific was absolutely vital as well. It was also a very different kind of campaign, and you really just have to look at a map of the two theaters to understand that. The Pacific Ocean, of course, the largest ocean, an ocean so large that you could fit all of the world's land masses into it with room to spare. And so it was the enormous distances and the remote nature of the islands that really sort of dominated this campaign and required an immense focus on developing the capability to project military force across great distances.
It's one of the fascinating parts of this book, and I'm hoping you can touch on it for us and give us an idea of the struggle between the strategy, the Pacific strategy, where you had those who were saying there had to be a step-by-step tactical triumph versus those who were saying it could be a cumulative sea and air operation.
Yeah, I think that's one way to look at the big problem of how to defeat Japan was what, you know, I had posited as the sequentialist versus the cumulativist approaches to defeating Japan. The sequential concept is it's a series of battles and conquest of island terrain, a series of naval battles. It's the way you can diagram the campaign on a map, and it's step by step. It's easier to understand, and for many people, I think, who read about the Pacific, that was the campaign. The cumulative concept is to attack the economic foundations of the enemy's war-making capability. And so the destruction of Japan's merchant marine, strategic bombing of Japanese industries and cities, even propaganda, these are strategies that kind of chip away at the foundations of the war-making potential of the enemy. That became very, very important in the Pacific through the submarine campaign, the strategic bombing campaign of the B-29s. And by the summer of 1945, Japan's ability to wage war was essentially sort of sputtering to a halt. And so I have told this story in a way that weaves together these two complementary strategies.
Let us talk for a moment about the Japanese naval and political decision-making that went on at this time. You do write, I mean, one of the things that I also found interesting was the kamikaze strategy. That is something that you portray as very controversial within the Japanese military.
Yeah, it was. The kamikazes were peculiar in that they really came out of something that is unique, I think, to the culture of Japan. And in particular, during that era, there was what has sometimes been called a kind of pathological death cult, in which many Japanese warriors, by the time they realized the war was lost, began to look for a death in combat as an end in itself, as a kind of a way out, an honorable way out, perhaps even a face-saving technique for both individuals and for the entire culture. At the same time, the introduction of organized suicide tactics with the kamikazes and with some of the other specialized suicide weapons, that was very controversial within Japanese society and even within the Japanese military at first. There was a great deal of resistance to it. And it wasn't introduced until the fall of 1944. And even then, down the ranks, there was a good deal of resistance. And I think that that resistance is something that has been overlooked in many Western histories of the Pacific War.
You suggest in your book that when the first bombs were dropped on Pearl Harbor is really the moment that Japan lost the Pacific War.
Yeah, I think that is the case. Japan was still a relatively small and emerging industrial power. Their industrial base was something that had been conjured up from almost nothing in a matter of a couple of decades. And they deliberately chose to take on a country, the United States, that was locally weak in the Pacific and unprepared for war, but possessed something like 10 times Japan's latent industrial military strength. And so that was a fateful decision to make an enemy out of the United States when really they had the option not to do that. And it was one of the greatest miscalculations in history, perhaps. It was founded on this assumption that the American people didn't have the stomach to fight a long war on the other side of the world, and that perhaps because we were a democracy, our people would demand that our leaders sue for peace. And, of course, by attacking Pearl Harbor in the way that they did, they united the country. They essentially eliminated the isolationist movement. And from that point forward, I think it was virtually inevitable that the war would end the way it did.
For you, having done what many of us would call an exhaustive look at this conflict, and through your Pacific War trilogy, are there still nagging major questions that you have?
Well, I think there are a number of kind of individual points that you could say are still in contention. But, just to pick one of them, I think that the question of whether we should have used the atomic bombs in the way that we did will always remain controversial. And the reason it will remain controversial, I think, is because no amount of historical research can ultimately settle that question, that controversy. It really comes down to a very difficult moral and ethical kind of calculation. For decades, really, at least probably since the Vietnam era, there have been fairly strong taboos among Americans in talking about this subject. And we've just passed the 75th anniversary of the end of the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
You know, looking forward, when we reach the 100th anniversary, we will have reached a point in which the living link has been cut. That is, there will be no more World War II veterans. They will have passed. No one will be able to look back on the events of August 1945 and say, I remember what happened. I remember how it felt. And so, you know, we reach a point in these next 25 years when everyone who looks at this subject will be looking at it, the same way we look at the American Civil War. That is, it's a historical event that has passed from living memory. My own view is that I think that the use of the atomic bombs was justified given the peculiar circumstances of that time. I think it's a much harder question to say whether or not it was the right thing to drop them on cities. And my own view is that if it had been possible to end the war without doing that, by hitting military targets, as an American, I think thinking about the country's legacy, I think that would have been a much preferable way to secure our goals, which were to obtain a Japanese surrender without an invasion.
And those decisions, I mean, there were other places obviously on the list, but that decision in a timeline was made rather quickly, wasn't it?
It was really the events of the end of the war were compressed into a very constricted chronology. The American leaders were in Germany at the time that the major decisions were made for the Potsdam Conference with the Allies. And because of the closely guarded secrecy of the Manhattan Project, the circle of people who participated in that decision was very small. And I think all of those factors kind of contributed to what may have been an overhasty decision.
After you have spent so much time on this chronicle in these three volumes, have you thought of what is next?
I have, yeah. I've given quite a bit of thought to it. I think that there's more to be said about the Second World War. I'm particularly interested in how the United States was able to respond to this crisis in the sense of organizing the society at home, sometimes called the home front. I think of it more as our political system. You know, we're in an election year now, and the stress that we repeatedly see that is placed upon our now 230-year-old constitutional system, you know, it's survived one crisis after another. And unlike other democracies, we have a fixed election calendar. So We've had contested presidential elections during the Civil War. That happened again during the Second World War. It's remarkable that as a society we've been able to withstand political strife at a time when it's necessary to unite as a country to deal with the threat. And so I see more work to be done in that aspect of the conflict.
Hmm. Fascinating project. In the meantime, the final volume of Ian Toll's History of the Pacific War is Twilight of the Gods, War in the Western Pacific, 1944 to 1945. It is published by Norton. Ian Toll, a great pleasure. Thank you very much for spending time with us.
Joe, thanks for having me.
Be well. Thank you very much. Again, the name of the new book is Twilight of the Gods, War in the Western Pacific, 1944 to 1945. It is published by Norton. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.